Welcome back, everybody. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're going to talk about the vice presidential debate last night here on the Steiner Show and this next hour. And if you are listening, if you're here, where we're broadcasting from in Baltimore, and you weren't listening to the Orioles game, maybe you watched the VP debate. But wherever you're listening to us from, please do join us. We're joined by Dr. Ann McCarthy, Dean of the Business School at Hamline University in Minneapolis, former Maryland resident when she ran for controller here as a Republican. Ann, good to have you back with us.
Hi, Mark.
George Zornick joins us, Washington editor for The Nation. George, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Charles Ellison joins us for the first part of our program here, national correspondent for WEA, host of the Ellison Report here on WEAA. Charles, good to have you back as well.
What's good, Mark? Thanks for having me.
And Denzel Mitchell's in the house, a commentator, food justice advocate, farmer, educator. Good to have you in the house, Denzel.
How you doing, Mark?
And sometimes a substitute host here on the Mark Steiner Show, we should add.
Oh, yes. 410 to my resume.
Yeah, please do. 410-319-8888 is the number to call to join in this conversation. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can also send us an email to talk@steinershow.org, but do join in, 410-319-8888, what we thought about last night's debate. I think George Zornick, like everybody thought that this debate last night was going to be dull and boring, but it was anything but. It was actually, I don't know how much substance was there, but it was, at least it was alive.
Alive is right, yeah. Tim Kaine kind of, I think, purposely came off as a jerk. I mean, I think that was the reception that a lot of people I talked to who watched it said, and if you watch, you know, cable news always has the focus groups after, and the words they were thrown out about Kaine were rude and jerk, and people didn't like him. But he was on a mission to, at every single point that he possibly could, try to hold Donald Trump's record and statements up from Mike Pence to sort of rebut. And Pence, because who I think has national ambitions in 2020, and I think Kaine knew that, did not defend Trump in the way that I sort of expected him to, or the way that, you know, if Chris Christie was up there or someone else who was quite loyal to Trump would defend him. Mike Pence just sort of either at points said that Trump didn't say things, which he definitely did say, and the internet's full of fact checks and today about that, or he just sort of said, okay, well, yeah, Donald's not a polished politician, but I'm here to bait me. And I think that was clearly Mike Pence auditioning for 2020.
I want to come back to that point about Mike Pence in 2020 and who Mike Pence really is in this. Ann McCarthy?
I felt like I was watching a session of judo. Seriously. We thought, you know, first of all, I didn't expect karate, but I also didn't expect judo. But Mike Pence was like a judo master. Everything that Kaine sent his way, he just sort of twisted around and took softly and aimed it right back. Sometimes it had backing away from Trump or not answering the question directly. Sometimes it was simply, well, what about Hillary? That's a classic judo move. And it was, I thought, in terms of Mike Pence, it was masterful. But then I also know he's been a talk show host. No, I'm not saying anything negative about you, Mark. And so he's more polished, I think, than what we saw last night than Kaine was.
He was very smooth. I have to get into it. He was very smooth. Charles Ellison?
Right. So, you know, it was like watching Darth Vader with a lightsaber and Frodo Baggins with a wiffle ball bat. I mean, that's pretty much what it amounted to. Pence obviously was extremely calm, very smooth, and actually he looked very presidential, and he could give you this impression that he'd be very ready if something were to happen in the White House. And in some respects, you know, you have a lot of Republicans. You even had some Democrats who were saying, you know, this should be the guy running for who should have ran for the Republican nomination for president. This is who they should have picked. So there was a lot of buyer's remorse on the GOP side. And Kaine was just very jittery, very jumpy. He was trying to play the role of attack dog too much. Now, fortunately for Kaine, the reigning narrative this morning is about how Pence was unable to adequately defend his boss, to adequately defend Trump. You know, he just seemed more concerned about sort of situating himself for 2020 play than focusing right now on 2016.
Denzel Mitchell.
I agree with what everybody said. I actually really would have preferred to either watch the Orioles, and I don't like baseball, the WNBA playoffs, the BET Hip Hop Awards. But you asked me to come on the show, so I had to watch it last night. And to me, it was like watching a really late night, partially drunk conversation. You know, two guys talking about their bosses. It was pretty ridiculous.
So, having said all that, I mean, I was tweeting during the whole thing. I don't know if any of you all were, but Charles, I guess you were as well, and George. And I
Donald Trump was tweeting too.
I'm sure he was.
Yeah.
So let me play some clips here from this thing. See what we think. Mm-hmm. Is the clip ready? Gun, we're ready. So we're going to play this one clip, and I think this one is about choice and pro-life.
Mm. Why don't you trust women to make this choice for themselves? We can encourage people to support life, of course we can, but why don't you trust women? Why doesn't Donald Trump trust women to make this choice for themselves? That's what we ought to be doing in public life, living our lives of faith or motivation with enthusiasm and excitement, convincing each other, dialoguing with each other about important moral issues of the day.
Because
but on fundamental issues of morality,
because
we should let women make their...
So, and then Pence came back with a very passionate, which if we have, we'll play in a moment, a passionate plea for life, and why, as a Catholic, he has to support that. And when they had this conversation about... how their religious convictions would affect them as vice president, or how it would affect their political lives. And I thought this is really, you know, and I think we got to remember here, I'm going to throw this out here, and just to remember that Governor Pence in March signed a bill into law that required burial or cremation for aborted fetuses, and wants to send Roe v. Wade to the ash heap of history, as was his quote. And this didn't really come out in the debate last night, but I think, you know, when we say that the debate may not have shifted people from one side to the other, it is critical to understand who these two men are if one of them becomes vice president, because they are, as we say, a heartbeat away. So it's not a minor issue what they stand for. We still didn't learn, I think, at all last night, George, what either one really stood for.
Well, I think you saw Tim Kaine make a case that has frustrated maybe a lot of people on the left, because it's a case that Hillary Clinton has increasingly made. And one is, there's sort of two parts of it. One is this kind of weird new hawkishness, particularly on Russia, where Kaine was almost coming at Pence from the right, or what we tend to think of the right as being too soft on foreign policy, too Putin-friendly and frankly not hawkish enough. And the rest of it was a good job saying what kind of incompetent and crazy, for lack of a better word, candidate Donald Trump is, and questioning his competency for the office, which is fine and good as far as it goes. But I think what Kaine didn't describe, and partly this may go to your question because we don't really know a lot about what Kaine believes. He's kind of a middle-of-the-road guy. He didn't really make the broader bread and butter economic populist case for Clinton's candidacy. And there were things that certainly he could use if he wanted to do that. You know, he could talk, I think he mentioned free college fleetingly, but, you know, re-regulating the financial sector and climate change and debt free college. He didn't really make that case. His two-pronged argument was basically Donald Trump is unusually unfit for office and, as well, too soft on foreign policy and too Putin-friendly.
Well, I sort of agree with George, because Tim Kaine spent so much time interrupting and then actually asking Pence questions and not letting Pence answer them, that after a while, I think people just walked away like, who is this guy? He's just not a nice person. We were told he was a nice person. He was supposed to, you know, smooth over the rough edges of Hillary Clinton. And it turns out he's not particularly nice either, except that he cares passionately about life. And he is actually anti-abortion himself. He has said that clearly when he ran for governor. But he will also say, that's my personal belief, but I live by the laws of this land, which I actually respect on his part, that he can have a personal belief that then is not necessarily imposed on everyone else, because we do live by the, you know, laws of the land.
Yeah, I think, you know, Pence came off very smooth. He came off very polished. And that was good. You know, optically, that was very good for Pence. But, you know, in terms of the conversation, the very public conversation that's taken place in the wake of that vice presidential debate, let's also remember that it just seemed like Pence was in another world. He was in this parallel universe of denial last night. And that didn't reflect on him too well. You even have, you know, some Republican strategists I was talking to off record, and also folks who are very familiar with the inner workings of the Trump camp, who were saying that, you know, not even Trump campaign officials were really all that pleased with Pence's performance. They felt like he could have done a much better job of defending Trump, and he didn't. That said, Kane missed a big opportunity here to turn this into the substantive policy conversation that we've all been yearning for, that we haven't been getting from the two main candidates. And instead of, you know, focusing so much on being an attack dog against Donald Trump, you know, or even saying Donald Trump's name, you know, stop saying Donald Trump's name. I mean, even Michelle Obama is smart about that. Michelle Obama is on the campaign trail, and you notice she never says Donald Trump's name. I mean, actually, Donald Trump's biggest advertisers are his opposition.
Start
focusing on why you could be a better president and stop focusing on why this guy shouldn't be president. And so, you know, Tim Kaine could have changed the whole trajectory of the public conversation about who you should vote for president, you know, only less than 40 days out from the election. And he just failed miserably at doing that.
See, I think Mike Pence knows, like the rest of America, that there is no defending Donald Trump. So don't even go there. And what the Clinton campaign hasn't figured out is don't even bother criticizing the man, because the people who are going to vote for him are going to vote for him no matter how much Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine and the whole Democratic establishment criticizes him and calls him names. It doesn't gain them any traction, because the people who are in the middle don't like that kind of politics. And instead, they're rushing to Gary Johnson away from Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the role that Pence served in last night. He was kind of the nice guy, mm-hmm. right? So he handled the debate very well. His feathers didn't get ruffled, you know. But at the same time, what people missed is that he was interrupting Tim Kaine. And even more so, he was interrupting the moderator. And so it ended up being an argument between these two guys, where Tim Kaine is attacking Mike Pence, and Mike Pence is just kind of sitting back calmly and refusing to defend his boss. But that's your boss. Like, y'all running buddies. And so this is how your boss talk. That's your boy. You're not gonna defend him. You're not gonna defend him. You know, he's like, well, actually, I'm planning on running for president in 2020. So, you know, what Donald Trump has been saying, I don't know anything about that. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, that was a good
George. Go ahead.
I think that was a good real-time look at how the Republican Party is going to handle the question of Trump after the election. If, mm-hmm. if you assume that he loses, you know, there's this big question, well, how does the GOP grapple with the fact that a record number of Republicans voted in the primary and they chose Donald Trump? And I think it's overwhelmingly clear that they will choose the Pence strategy, which is just to pretend that Donald Trump never existed.
Never existed, right?
He didn't say these things. No, he didn't say that. That never happened. What? What are you talking about? And they're just going to try to move on. Now, is that going to work? I don't know, but that's clearly going to be the approach.
I mean, this is a bad nightmare for all of us, right? This is a bad dream for all of us, right? That, you know, anybody over the age of 35 is continuously scratching their head over the fact that Donald Trump is the presidential candidate for the United States of America. I mean, this is absolutely crazy.
Oh, my 80-year-old mother looks at me and just wants to cry.
Right, you're right. Even Mama Bush is, you know, what is she, 93 now? And she's like, there's no way you could vote for Donald Trump.
Let me just say that I think that this debate last night between Kaine and Pence didn't change anybody's mind, and didn't move people from one camp to the other. I don't think, unlike the first debate, presidential debate, I don't think this moved undecided one way or the other in a major way either. At least not what I've been reading, or even my gut reaction analysis after watching the debate. But I think that that's why I think this next debate Sunday night could be so really critically important in this race, about what comes out of that for the undecideds who intend to vote, those who are wavering one way or the other, who are not sure. I mean, I think this is, you know, that you know, it is crazy. I mean, but that's where we are, and I think that it says a lot about the depth of the anti-establishment fervor in America.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't leave the issue of race out of the out of what that dynamic is as well. But both things play into this. But I think that there's a real dislike of the establishment, and that's why I think you're seeing so many. And Anne, I'll go to you, and then just jump into this. And I think that's why we're seeing so many establishment politicians, conservative and liberal and moderate, all coming out for Hillary, because the establishment is afraid of this uprising they're seeing in America and what that might portend. Anne?
I agree. You know, Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders is the Donald Trump of the Democratic Party, and he's
not. Bernie's not crazy.
He's not, but he represents the a part of the core of the party that's just tired of dynasties. Mm-hmm. I mean, we may not like Donald Trump, but the one thing he showed us was that people on the Republican side are sick of the Bush dynasty. As smart as Jeb is, as calm as he is, no, we don't want Bushes anymore. Unfortunately, Debbie Wasserman Schultz didn't have her ear to the ground that the Democrats are almost equally sick of the Clinton dynasty. Cory Booker could be waltzing his way into the White House if he were the Democratic nominee. So could Deval Patrick. There's great talent on the Democratic side, and instead they go with, really, quite frankly, somebody who most of the nation cannot stand. They think she's a hypocrite and a liar. And they're right. So she'll get in, and you know what will happen? 4 years of nothing but congressional investigations and locked, terrible congressional lockdown. And, things that just will just be in nowhere land for 4 years.
Yeah, but you have to ask the question. I mean, what politician is not two-faced? What politician is not a liar? What politician is not hypocritical? And I've worked for many of them. I mean, they all sort of make that sort of calculus. You know, they all sort of pivot that way. That's the nature of the beast as far as the history of politics. And I mean, what guarantee is there that you won't have that type of congressional gridlock, ongoing investigations, and just nonstop toxicity on Capitol Hill? If there wasn't a Clinton, I think you'd have that regardless of who wins on November 8th. I think if you had a Cory Booker or a Deval Patrick, somebody would find something on Capitol Hill, particularly amongst House Republicans. I mean, somebody would find something to hammer them with for the next 4 to 8 years, because that's just, it's not about who's about to get elected for president. It's not about that there's that you have a Clinton or a Trump as the nominee. Is that you have a very polarized, very resentful, toxic political environment now. And that's been around for quite some time, even before 2016. I mean, a lot of us saw this coming probably on the inauguration day of Barack Obama. We saw this especially in the 2010 congressional midterms, and we saw signs of it really, I mean, since the 1994 Republican Revolution that took over Capitol Hill, that Newt Gingrich brought into play. So, you know, let's not act like this is something that's just fresh and new, and let's not act like it's only the election of Clinton that's going to trigger it.
Oh, yeah, that's, no, I agree with that. And if that's the impression I left, I didn't mean to do that. You're right. There is at some level among the voters in the country a great divide, and this is just sort of a symptom of that great divide.
George?
Yeah, I mean, just to echo that, Obama came in 2008 as one of the most popular incoming presidents in history, a sort of transcendent figure, and the public opinion polls on the Republican Party were just terrible. And he came in January of the first month and got no Republican votes in the House for his stimulus package. So the idea that gridlock is baked into the system here, and really what it is, and it's sort of related to what led to Donald Trump, it's sort of the death cry of the Republican Party, who, as they lose political power, turn more and more to sort of hardline tactics to, first of all, they're enthralled to a base that wants absolutely no compromise of any kind, with Democrats. There was a good interview that Obama gave to New York Magazine this week where he said Republican leaders will tell him, I can't even be photographed with you. You know, they will ask him to attack them to make their lives easier. So that's going to be the dynamic no matter what going forward. I don't disagree that Hillary Clinton is not particularly possible as far as presidential candidates go. But we'll see when, if she gets into office. She generally seems to get much higher approval ratings when she's actually in a job. When she was Secretary of State, she had very high approval ratings. And she wasn't at center stage, and Obama was absorbing a lot of the flack that was coming from Capitol Hill. So that's certainly true. But as a senator and as a Secretary of State, she tends to do a lot better than in campaign. So it would be interesting to see if that changed. I wouldn't take it for granted for sure that she will remain unpopular for 4 years.
You said you don't take it for granted?
No, I don't take it for granted at all. I think it's possible at least that she would get increasingly popular as time goes on. And a lot of that is just fundamentally unknowable about what happens in the next 4 years and what kind of things she decides to push on Capitol Hill and Lord knows what else comes up in the world. But that would be not a surprising trend if people kind of took a kinder look at her once she was in the job. And once you had the veneer of sort of the first woman president taking office, like that's going to mean something to a lot of people that may not be apparent now in the day-to-day back and forth, but I think will be a big moment if and when it happens.
If it does happen, you'll have three of the major nation states in the world led by women, the U.S., mm-hmm. the U.K., and Germany.
The Trump-like candidate in Germany is calling Hillary Clinton America's Merkel. This is what I find interesting as well. But you were going to say something, Denzel.
Yeah, the only thing I wanted to add, going back to the debate, was that listening, there's just this repeated loop of sound bites. You know, so the moderator asked a question. She asked a question about domestic terrorism, and they started again to talk about immigration reform and Syrian refugees, and never answered the question. She asked a question about policing and racial bias, and they started talking about crime. It's the same, you know, it's the same thing. And so again, educators, the American citizenry is not being educated on who these candidates are. It's just this relooping of the same rhetoric that's, you know, that's completely useless.
I agree, but Mike Pence is a very ultra-conservative Republican.
Right.
And Tim Kaine is a middle-of-the-road Democrat, I would say.
Mick Caprino tweeted in, I've been saying that for 20 years might not be fair for families that are all in public service. Too bad, talking about dynasties. Should we take a quick break and come right back, and then we'll go right to the phones. Dwayne, you're the next first caller up. We're going to come to your call when we come back. Charles Ellison, I know you have to run. I deeply appreciate you being here.
Hey, thanks as always. Take care, Mark.
Take care, and listen to him Sunday night on 9 o'clock at WEAA for the Ellison Report. Back with our three guests and more. Don't go away. Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us. On the way back to a conversation, I want to remind you, Mark Steiner's show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or SteinerShow.org is Maryland State Education Association's banner. We're here with George Zornick, Washington editor for The Nation magazine. Denzel Mitchell, food justice advocate, farmer, educator, and host here on the Mark Steiner Show. Dr. Ann McCarthy, dean of the business school at Hamline University in Minneapolis, and ran for comptroller here in Maryland some years back. This is where how we met. You all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Let's go right to the phones. Dwayne, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you, Wayne. Good morning. Good morning.
So my question to the panelists is, How do we get to a higher level political electorate and a higher level political candidacy when there's always so much focus on personality versus character in the way that the media, you know, tries to inform us about the candidates. There's always so much focus on, oh, this guy seems so cool and he seems so presidential. When at the end of the day, this seems so presidential means zip. What is the substance of the candidate?
I think, George, that's a great critique of our media. That was the people were talking about how smooth Pence was. There's not been really any analysis of what either one of these men stand for in the major press. Well, that's not true, but there has not been enough, especially in TV.
No, you said it right the first time. In major press, there has not been enough analysis. It's just like Ann just said. You know, you can boil it down into a very simple statement that Mike Pence is an extremely conservative right-wing politician, and Tim Kaine is a middle-of-the-road Democrat.
I mean, George, you want to come out? You know, we read about Governor Pence. You know, he wrote an op-ed that I was looking at again the other night, that smoking doesn't kill. he wanted use of public funds for conversion therapy. And, you know, it took money away from TANF to give to crisis pregnancy centers. Mm-hmm. I mean, people don't realize, you know, I mean, who he is, and I don't think we spend enough time talking about what the potential next vice president or presidential candidate in 2020, who he really is. George?
Yeah, we may hear about that if he ends up running. But, it's just, to the caller's point, it's so kind of strange, and I think it goes beyond the media. It's more of a cultural problem that voting for presidential candidates has become more of an emotion than choosing someone to run the executive branch. And we have a great, if I can pause, a great cover story coming out in The Nation, an essay on Donald Trump by a novelist, Adam Hazlett. And this is kind of the point he's making, is just that, you know, more than anything else, Trump is an emotion. He is a feeling. And that's been true for a while. It's not unique to Trump. I mean, that was in some ways true of Obama, but it sort of subsumes a real political debate about what policies are. I think in some way it's just sort of natural, because we basically know and have known, you know, what the Democratic Party stands for. We know what the Republican Party stands for: tax cuts, deregulation. So in some ways, there's not a lot of new policy ground to go over, and it does shift into more of a personality-driven thing. But really, especially with TV and social media, just choosing a president has become so much more different than just sort of evaluating policy A versus policy B. It's how you feel about the country and how you feel about yourself.
Anne, you want to jump in on that before I throw another question out here?
Well, in response to the call, we have become a nation of personality watchers. It started with People magazine, mm-hmm. and it's just continued on to reality TV. And he's right. Our press sort of lets us down by paying more attention to the personalities than to the policies, because who are we going to depend on to get the real story if not the Fourth Estate, the press? And they're almost as enamored of the personality cult as everybody else is, and it's a sad thing.
And I do want to apologize to our listeners and our guests here. We have this technical difficulty across, and we couldn't play the other clips that we had lined up, but let me just talk about a few of them. One of the things that I was going to try to hit here was the conversation on immigration, which forms the centerpiece of this campaign. And, you know, it was kind of strange. You know, it's like when Kaine was saying that Secretary Clinton's immigration plan was like Reagan's in 86, what does that say? I mean, is everybody trying to kind of, you know, figure out where it is, kind of fit together? I'm not even sure how that even fits into reality. But I when you look at that, and also the kind of fear mongering that takes place around refugees coming to America, how the courts just ruled against Pence around Syrian refugees and the money that was the federal money for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me that when you look at that, it's I don't know, George, I wonder if I'm making too much of this or not, but I feel like we're like. There's no serious thought about how to address these issues. We're just kind of playing games around it.
Yeah, I think what Kaine was referencing there is that Ronald Reagan did grant amnesty to most of the undocumented people, and that's a hardline position now that the Republican Party stands against. It's really interesting if you want to look at how Trump kind of came to be. If you look at opinion polls, and this has been pretty consistent, what unites the Republican Party is basically two things. Number one is diehard opposition to the Democratic Party, feeling that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi are existential threats to the country. That's number one. Number two is being opposed to any further immigration and taking a hardline stance on that issue. And that cuts across Tea Partiers, evangelicals, moderate Republicans, Catholic Republicans, I mean, coastal area, everything. And those are really the only two things that unite all parts of the party. So this will not be, to the question, this will not be the last election that immigration is a huge issue and ultimately becomes a hardline position on the Republican side. I have no idea, and it would be useless to speculate who's going to be the Republican nominee in 2020, and that's even assuming that Trump doesn't win. But that person, regardless of what their position is now, will end up at a hardline immigration spot by the end of that primary because that's just where the voters are.
So if you took that on from the other side, Ann McCarthy, I mean, what about the future of the Republicans?
I don't think there's a future for the Republicans. I see the party going so far to the right. Think about Justice Stevens, who was nominated by Nixon, who was considered a conservative at the time that he was nominated, would now be considered too left-leaning to be nominated by any Republican president. The party has gone so right that the people like me, we don't have a party anymore. I have voted more Democrat in the past 10 years than I have voted for Republican because there is no real Republican Party anymore except these extreme. I mean, Ted Cruz is almost in some sense no better than Donald Trump in his policy stance. He's just smarter. And Mike Pence is no better. He's even worse than Ted Cruz. Where is the future of the Republican Party? Marco Rubio couldn't even get traction, and he's probably the most moderate of them because he had an immigration policy that made sense, and he had to back away from it. Otherwise, he was going to lose his Senate seat. So I think that once the Clintons, you know, fade into history, you're going to see Democrats dominate the national stage for the next 20 years. The Republicans lost their way.
Denzel, I know your thoughts because you don't lean either way.
Well,
Democrat Republican.
Right. I still don't know what I'm going to do with my vote. I'm not voting for Donald Trump. You know, Dee Watkins just wrote a fantastic piece in the Salon about not voting for Hillary or why, you know, somebody like me wouldn't want to vote for Hillary either. What do you do with your vote? And you know what Ann just said was incredibly depressing.
Sorry.
I mean, no. I mean, I the way you articulated it, I already knew. But this is really sad. You know, the state of American politics has more or less been reduced down to one party. That, you know, that's represented by two groups that at the end of the day don't represent the real needs of this country, and that no progressive or constructive movement or reform, you know, around the issues that I'm really concerned about. You know, so I don't know who to vote for in this election. You know, and you know, even beyond that, you know, my kids are asking me, "Well, is there anybody else running for president?" And you know, there actually is, but the major media doesn't give those people a voice. And so, the young people that need to be educated—you're
talking about Jill Stein, the Greens, and Gary Johnson, and the Libertarians,
right. You know, and obviously they don't have a chance, a snowball's chance in hell of winning the presidential debate. But for conversation purposes, like it would have been nice. And I know Democracy Now! Did this, but it would be nice for there to be that conversation, right? At least there would have been some real conversation about immigration and about the foreign policy in Syria and Russia, police reform, education, all these conversations that I don't feel like Pence or Kaine answered, right? Pence is vying for the national stage in 2020. Kaine is supporting his his boss and Hillary Clinton, you know, but there was really no real conversation. And I still don't know who to vote for.
I agree. If there were a third person on that stage, it would change the dynamic incredibly. Instead of hurling insults at each other all the time, they could maybe get down to having a real conversation about the things. I mean, there are 100 million Americans out of work. And yes, President Obama inherited a tremendous mess. And yes, he's done a good job, I think, from my point of view. But there are still 100 million Americans out of work and close to 10 million additional ones who are underemployed. So, meaning that they're working at marginal jobs. I mean, people, this is why Donald Trump is getting somewhere. And it's wrong, and I don't like the man, and it's an embarrassment. But he's tapping into those people who have gotten left out of the recovery from the Great Recession. And instead of hearing real plans about what we're going to do about retraining people and putting them into higher paying jobs, we get insults.
The GOP is also tapping into, you know, this American historical amnesia, right? And they're blaming Clinton and Obama for the war, for the problems with foreign policy, for the joblessness rate, as if this hasn't been an issue for the last 16 years, you know? I mean, terrorism hasn't been an Obama problem. It wasn't caused by Obama. This has been an issue because of the policies of the United States. You know.
So let me just read this piece, and I'm going to go to George. We haven't heard his voice in a couple minutes, but you all can comment on this. Valerie wrote in, I think we need to vote for the next Supreme Court. I'm not voting for Hillary because I'm voting for her. I'm voting because I don't want Donald Trump to affect generations of children, women, and persons of color by appointing right-wing justices. George?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the many crazy things about this political year is that since February, the Supreme Court has been in session without one of its members. They just started hearing arguments again this week, and Merrick Garland is sort of a forgotten name in all this debate, but that's right. Actually right, and I've heard that from a lot of people, both on the left and the right, people who are not comfortable with Clinton but are voting for the Supreme Court, or they don't like Trump, but they realize what the stakes are. And I think that's absolutely a good reason to do it, because those are lifetime seats. You have one seat that's clearly in the balance. You have a couple other justices who are over 80, I believe.
Yeah.
So it's not a trivial point at all.
Right.
And just to push on a little bit before we run out of time, Denzel, because you were raising the issue about, you know, why you're about who to vote for and who not to vote for. And I think it is confusing for many of us, but I mean, I think that is an issue, because there's decisions around voting rights, around women's right to choose, around certain environmental issues, and many other things I could mention. Voting rights, for one. I mean, it'll affect a generation to come. It'll affect your children, who are all not yet of voting age, right?
Exactly.
All
right.
Five of them. I mean, it'll affect them. It'll affect the young people in my family who are in their teens and early 20s. It's going to affect this generation to come. Mm. It's not a small point.
No, it's not. Not at all. I mean, that is a very, very, very huge point, something to consider when you go into the ballot box. It's like, okay, well, I would like for there to be a moderate, sensible human being sitting on the Supreme Court for the next 20 years, and then, you know, you just ride the wave, you know, with who's sitting in the Oval Office.
Anne, you want to leap in on that one as well?
Well, no, I agree. It is an issue, and it's a shame what they've done to Judge Garland. It's just another example of why Congress is only a peg above, I don't know what, somebody like Undertakers or somebody worse in, you know, trustworthiness. Actually, I think Congress is below big business. You know, you asked earlier, Margaret, I'm going to change the subject. I think the Supreme Court is very important, but how do we affect social change? I think the way we affect social change is when neighbors to neighbors suddenly embrace each other's differences. So I'm thinking back a couple of years ago here in the state of Minnesota, we had the amendment to ban gay marriage, and they had ads of these people out on what they call the Iron Range up in northern Minnesota, which is very conservative. And they had people on there saying, you know, my son or my grandson loves another man, and I love my grandson and I think it's okay. And these are like dyed-in-the-wool right-wing conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what begins to get us to change, the fact that we know somebody who came here from Mexico who's working hard and raising a family and doing a great job. And then we have to stop listening to the people who are trying to instill fear in us and say, enough of this. We want somebody else leading this country. And I don't know how we get there unless we all begin to do it together.
You know, George, I think that this is there's clear ideological differences in this country and visions of America, where we are. But I think people are also just as frustrated by what Anne is describing as our inability to really kind of to understand our commonality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And there's big problems that need to be solved. If you're watching the cable news flashes right now, seeing that a million people in South Carolina are being evacuated as a hurricane goes towards it. I mean, it's kind of crazy to me that through two presidential debates, there has not been a single question about climate change. And
right,
this is
right.
Another one of these things that, you know, can't be ignored and can't be put off. And it puts huge stakes into the presidential race. And those are exactly the kind of things that she mentioned, that just there's a common urgency here and there are needs that are not being met.
Mm-hmm. Denzel?
No, I completely agree.
Because I'm asking this for two reasons. A, you're a man that has very clear political convictions, mm-hmm. On the left,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
And also as a man who's deeply involved in issues around race and really thinks about issues of race and racism in this country and what we have to do to overcome them. So,
right, right.
I mean, how do you respond
right.
in that vein?
Yeah, so, you know, so first thing is obviously non-party affiliated, so I willingly disenfranchised myself during the primaries. And so I'm really talking from a place of being an outsider, neither Democrat nor Republican, and having some serious convictions around race and class and education and family. You know, this is incredibly problematic because people like me, I believe, are not included in these conversations concerning electoral politics. And in the conversations that I have and the cultural expressions that I see and the art that I listen to and I absorb, it says the exact same thing. So there's a huge swath of people in this country who don't believe that they're being talked to. Right, and they're looking at what's happening as if it were a house on fire, and they have great ideas on how to address that fire, but no one is listening. No one's listening to them, and so it's problematic because in a lot of ways it seems very simple, right? How do we address climate change, right? Instead of talking about the fact that Haiti is being destroyed, again. The Dominican Republic is being destroyed, that, you know, that Cuba is being affected by climate change as opposed to yet another hurricane, as if this is happening in some kind of vacuum, and that we all don't have some responsibility in affecting real change in this country and in this world. It's depressing, you know. It's problematic.
So we have to take a break here. But I do appreciate all of you being here. And when it comes, of course, Monday, we'll be hitting the ground running at 10 o'clock talking about the presidential debate coming up Sunday night, mm-hmm. which will be coming up. And maybe we'll have somebody back if you all are free, because that's a great discussion. Denzel Mitchell, always good to have you in the studio. Thank you very much. Food justice advocate, farmer, educator, host here on The Mark Steiner Show. George Zornick, Washington editor for The Nation. Always great to have you with us, George. Thank you so much for taking the time. As well as you, Dr. Anne McCarthy, Dean of the Business School at Hamline University in Minneapolis. Thank the three of you so much, and earlier Charles Ellison for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And on a way to break here, I wanted to remind you all to join us tonight for the 5th anniversary celebration for the Alliance of Community Teachers in Schools. It'll be an evening where we'll have a conversation together on racial inequity and resilience in our public education system, racism in our schools. How do we address that? I'll be moderating a discussion with Taylor Branch, Karen Weber, and Edward Fergus. Do join us over at the Radisson Hotel. You can check on tickets at actscelebrate.eventbrite.com. And we'll also be putting that on our webpage. But do come and join us there tonight. Take a short break and come back. It's time to see what's happening in the city paper. Don't go away.